Okay, the topic for tonight is really biology. We've covered a lot of sciences, but we have not dealt with the biological, which takes us into evolution. It takes us into genetics, and it takes us, of course, into our creation faith that we have, which is, you know, to a good degree based on the Genesis creation stories. So always start with the big picture. We're exploring science and faith. And now we come to what has proven to be the most contentious topic, even still today. The science of biology, which of course is going to include the work of Charles Darwin. It will include the topic of evolution. And so at the core of our faith, we have this affirmation. Again, this is stuff that you know very, very well. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, core to our faith. This means a couple of things. For one, it means that we believe that all that exists has come into being through the creative act of God. You might say it's the religious side of the Big Bang. It has to do with origins. There's also a second aspect to our understanding of creation. Not only do we affirm that the universe has its origin in God, we also affirm historically that the universe is sustained by the ongoing presence and the ongoing activity of God. That creation refers not only to an event in the past, creation also refers to an ongoing process. It's the second aspect that has become the lightning rod in the relationship between science faith. This is an actual photograph taken from the Scopes monkey trial back in 1925. So going back right at 100 years ago, during the 1920s, this became a very much of a flashpoint. And up to today, we have intelligent design arguments. We have debates over what should or should not be in our textbooks that we teach, you know, that we teach our kids. And so for 100 years, this has been an ongoing kind of discussion. And it's times less than the discussion, devolving into more shouting matches. Creation and evolution, as you very well know, have been pitted against each other by people on both sides. We have some in the faith community that have seen evolution as a threat to the faith. Here's a historic picture from back in the 1920s, but we have our parallel versions of that even today. And of course, some in the science community have seen religious belief as a threat to science. So books like Dawkins' The God Delusion, Stringer's God, The Failed Hypothesis, and there's a cottage industry of those books. Both of these positions see the relationship between faith and science as binary, that we have to choose. It's one or the other. And if one is right, the other has to be wrong. That you see that in both extremes. This is in spite of the fact that many, even a majority in the science communities and the faith communities, simply do not see that there's any conflict here whatsoever. So let me give you a couple of examples. Let's look at the science side first. This is a statement from the National Academy of Sciences, the official scientific body of the United States. They have a whole section on evolution. And under that, they have a little subsection called the compatibility of science and religion. And so this is the National Academy of Sciences statement. Today, many religious denominations accept that biological evolution has produced the diversity of living things over billions of years of Earth's history. Many of these religious groups have issued statements observing that evolution and the tenets of their faiths are indeed compatible. Scientists and theologians, people of science and people of faith, have written eloquently about their awe and wonder at the history of the universe and of life on this planet, explaining that they see no conflict between their faith in God and the evidence for evolution. Now, our own tradition as United Methodists is one of those Sees the two not as contradictory. If you double check to make sure that you're muted with a very strong feedback, I'd like not to have to stop the presentation to kind of block that. But see it as complementary to each other. I think we looked at this early in the series, but it's worth bringing back again. Because we as United Methodists are one of the examples that the National Academy of Sciences was referring to. This is our official statement. Science and theology are complementary rather than mutually incompatible. We recognize as United Methodists, science as the legitimate interpretation of God's natural world. And as United Methodists, we affirm the validity of the claims of science in describing the natural world. Now, if this is true from the science side and from the faith side, how then do we get this perception of so much conflict? To answer this is the task tonight of our program. We're going to do a little digging into science, and we're going to do a little digging into the history of our faith and kind of tell the story of why this has got to be an issue and why I'm of the view that it need not be an issue. Helpful to remember something that we dealt with in the session on geology, which was probably a couple months ago. So I'm going to go back just to pick up a few slides and remind ourselves of something. Because this is something I did not know, literally, until I did the research in geology and fossils. Prior to the 1800s, prior to the mid-1800s, everyone, including scientists, assumed that the Genesis creation narrative gave us accurate knowledge of the world, accurate scientific knowledge of the world. At the time, the Bible was thought to be the only document that went back to the beginning of time. And we have to remember that prior to the mid-1800s, people had a great respect for the ancients and their writings, whether it would be Aristotle or Plato or whoever, or the Bible. And ancient sources from the ancient world were considered solid sources of information. The Bible, and specifically the book of Genesis, was considered to be universally across the board a dependable and historically valued document. The founders of modern science, Copernicus, Newton, Kepler, Bacon, Galileo, run the table, all of them, were among those who simply assumed, that's the key word here, they just assumed that a literal reading of Genesis was inaccurate and it gave us good, solid information. No one had any reason to doubt this narrative. And there was nothing in the science of the time that suggested anything otherwise. But by the mid-1800s, the situation had shifted significantly. Remember, modern science goes back in some respects to the late 1500s, but particularly, say, 1650 forward, modern science is beginning to emerge. Basing science on Genesis during this period was no longer seen as being adequate from the scientific side to actually explain what was out there and what we were seeing and what we were finding. For example, in geology, we developed a sense of deep time and that there were natural processes at work in the world. Fossils had been discovered of creatures unlike any that are known today, meaning that they were extinct. This meant that all creatures were not created at the same time, contrary to how Genesis was being read. The key there is how Genesis was being read. Fossils created a couple of problems for the traditional biblical dating of the world. First, it showed progressive development. When we get into the biological side, again, one of the issues we're going to be talking about is sort of progressive development of species. But in the case of fossils, obviously we're dealing with a lot more time than we had thought that the world existed. Second, that some of the animals had become extinct. Extinct animals meant that not everything, again, are created at the same time. So the old simplistic way of reading the Bible as our best source for the past unraveled. And the 6 days of creation was simply not enough time to account for what we're saying. This is in the realm of geology and the realm of fossils. the biblical timeline, which was the accepted standard by everybody, would have to be reinterpreted. So in that program, we talked a lot about just that over a long period of time, in multiple stages, this timeline, the Noah timeline, had to be adapted. Science would need to be based on empirical observations rather than an ancient text, whether that text would be Aristotle or Plato or the Bible. This was one of the great turning points in science. This was the state of affairs when Charles Darwin set sail in the HMS Beagle in 1831. He lived in the great age of the empirical sciences, when people were studying just every single aspect of the world. Darwin was a naturalist. We today might say biologist, but the term at the time was naturalist. He was studying nature. He was trying to understand the diversity of the biological world through empirical observations, in the same way that his contemporaries who were geologists were trying to understand the diversity through rocks and fossils, but the diversity of the past. His research during the 5 years he was on HMS Beagle, and his reflection and his research over the next 23 years that followed. He spent 5 years on the Beagle. He spent another 23 going over his discoveries, reflecting on it, thinking about it, writing, refining, not publishing, because he wanted to be sure, because some of his insights ran against the accepted science at the time. This is not an issue running against religion. It was running against the science of the time. This led to his theory of evolution and the principle of natural selection, published in 1859 on The Origin of Species. Now, Darwin was not the first to propose that species evolved over time. Lamarck and others had already proposed theories of evolution. As a matter of fact, there was another guy that actually had came up with the same answer that Darwin did, but he did not know about this other guy. So there are multiple people were working on this, trying to understand it. The difference with Darwin, as opposed to Lamarck and some others, was that he proposed a mechanism for how this evolution or evolving could happen. Darwin gave, and this is actually a quote, a plausible mechanistic account of biological systems based on mutation and natural selection. That's the heart of The Origin of Species. Darwin did not use the term evolution, that it was not his word. He referred to the process as descent with modification. What is not generally known, or is widely known, that Darwin's theory was not widely accepted by the scientific community at the time, and that was a shock to me. Darwin's theory ran against accepted understanding, the accepted science, and almost nobody initially accepted Darwin. The irony is he got a warm reception from the religious community. He got a cold reception from the scientific community. It was not until the work of Gregor Mendel on inherited traits, something again that will later be called genes, from which we get genetics. Remember, Gregor Mendel there was a priest, Catholic priest. When the work of these two men were combined, Darwin's theory and Gregor Mendel's inherited traits in the early 1900s, we produced what is called the modern synthesis. It's also is Neo-Darwinism. That's the combination of these two things together. It's only then that Darwin's work was truly accepted. So this is happening right before the famous monkey trial. So this is really hitting the media, really getting out there in that early 20th century. And of course, then we get reaction to it that we see in the Scopes trial. In 1953, the publication of The Structure of DNA by James Watson, Francis Crick, and Rosalind Franklin demonstrated the actual physical mechanism for inheritance. So Mendel, in his research with the beans, postulated this, But then when DNA was discovered, we actually had discovered what he was talking about, the mechanism that this happened. Then the Human Genome Project, which began in 1990, and was only completed 13 years later in 2003, successfully mapped the entire human genome. One of the great feats of science. This has led to the modern science of genetics and countless revolutions in medical science. And you have to realize that this is only in the last 20 years that this has actually been in play. Today, we talked about it earlier, and some of you may have Googled this, but CRISPR. CRISPR is actually a molecular structure that is found in some bacteria that live in very, very adverse conditions, very, very hot springs, in areas you think life would not exist. And they've discovered that, and CRISPR stands for six words. Even when you read the six words, it still makes no sense whatsoever. You just think of it as scissors, okay? This is a molecular structure that allows us to edit genes. Edit it specifically, accurately, anywhere we want. Today, this is the cutting edge of modern genetic medicine. It is being used to cure, it's in the developmental stage, it is so new, but right now, you name the disease, cancer, all of the various diseases that are inherited genetically, they're going after with CRISPR. CRISPR technology is now being used to create rapid tests for the COVID-19 virus. You've been hearing about these tests that are 5 minute and 15 minutes. Well, these are CRISPR technology coming online. And by the way, they are also working using CRISPR for vaccines, for Ebola, for the COVID-19, and for other forms of viruses. This is very, very helpful to be used to do this kind of thing. All of this means that the pioneering work of Darwin and others have given us, or has given us, the most powerful tools we have to enhance life today. If you've seen that series on CRISPR, on Nova, they just lay it out. And scientists after scientists said this, of all of the developments of the human, of humans in the scientific world, this one by itself is potentially the most far-reaching. And in some ways, it has some scary parts to it, as any new science always does. Here's the point. The science is not in doubt. It is as solid as it comes, going all the way back to Darwin, coming forward. The question for us is, what does all this mean? What does this mean, you know, for faith? And what does it mean for our core affirmation that God is the source as well as the sustaining power for all that exists? As well as whether we can meaningfully talk about a guiding hand in the universe, which we do as people of faith, and whether all that happens is through blind mechanistic chance. You may have seen that language from outside the faith community. And whether Charles Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection, together with Gregor Mendel's theory of genetics and all of the developments that have flown out of that, as well as our subsequent understanding of DNA, which has proven to be a godsend in terms of medicine, are in any way at odds with our belief in God, who, as the creed affirms, our creed, who has created and is creating. There's that double affirmation that God is the source and that God is the sustaining power, which is, of course, a key element of our faith. Now, the perceived conflict lies in two areas. I'm going to mention both of them, but we're going to deal primarily with the second. The first area of conflict is in the area of cosmology. In other words, the creation as the source, God as the source, as well as biology, which is God, are the ongoing processes of the universe. The first area of conflict, based on the belief in scientific cosmology and creation faith, the belief that these two are contradictory explanations for the same thing. So if you view the creation narrative and science cosmology as basically talking about the same thing, then you may have some tension there. Central to the conflict are the two creation stories in Genesis. These are seen by some as foundational to our faith, which we all accept, but is seen by some as problematic for science. But here's the key. There is only a conflict if the two are talking about the same thing. And I'm going to argue they're not. The Genesis narratives were never meant to be scientific. That's anachronistic. If science emerges in the 17th century, you can't expect a document written, nearly 3,000 years earlier to be scientific in the way that we use that term. Now, let's be honest. It is true that at one level, the creation stories in Genesis contain cosmologies and ideas about the beginning. I mean, it says in the beginning, that they do in fact deal with the origin of all there is, as science does in cosmology. But that's not their primary purpose. The religious truth they see is presented in the worldview of the science at the time, specifically if you look at the little chart here. And when we get to Al and Tom, they use this construct in their book, and Tom may want to address that tonight. But the Babylonian worldview was what Tom and I referred to as an inverted bowl. And it was a common sense kind of thing. The idea was, rain falls in the heavens, the sky is blue, water is blue, therefore what is on the other side of the sky? Well, it must be water, so you have the ocean in heaven. And down below the earth, you have springs, water come out of the ground, so what must be below the earth? What must be water also? So you get this idea of creation of this little bubble. That is literally what you have in Genesis 1. The Babylonian creation story is taken by the biblical writers and used to teach the faith. But the point of Genesis is not to teach a Babylonian worldview or Babylonian science. Rather, the point Genesis, or the purpose of Genesis, is to teach truth about God. As Galileo famously said, you've heard this before, faith is about how to get to heaven, not how the heavens go. The writers of Genesis took the dominant worldview of the time, that the established science of the time, Babylonian science, and they made it religiously Jewish. And there's a polemical aspect to this. The creation narratives take the various Babylonian gods. We have to remember that the sun, the moon, and the stars, and those heavenly things that we see in Genesis 1, in the Babylonian mythology, these are all gods. And if you remember Genesis 1, these are creatures created by the God of Israel. So there's a polemical type thing there. You have your gods, well, your gods serve our God, and your gods were in fact made by our gods. The Genesis narratives are also full of what are called aetiologies. Don't be scared off by that word if you've not seen it. It means simply a story that seeks to explain why things are the way they are. So Genesis 1 and 2 are full of these things, particularly Genesis 2. Things like, why do we have to work by the sweat of our brow? Well, it's because of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Well, why do women experience pain at childbirth? Well, it's because of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Why do snakes crawl on their bellies? Well, it's because of what happened in the Garden of Eden. How are we like the rest of creation? Well, we're dust. For dust you are, and dust you shall return. How are we unique? Well, breath or spirit or image of God, depending if you're in Genesis 1 or Genesis 2. These two stories also explore much deeper issues, such as why is there suffering in the world? And why are things not the way God would have them to be? So all of these things, and by the way, these are all theological, spiritual, religious themes of meaning. That's the purpose of Genesis 1 and 2, not the science involved. Genesis is not primarily about the how or the mechanisms of the universe, even though it borrows some from the culture. In other words, it's not primarily about what we would know today as science, the how. If these stories were primarily about the how, we probably would not have two stories that contradict each other with humans being created first and one being created last in the other. Let's assume that the biblical writers were not that dumb. They knew, in fact, what they were doing. So that, this slide here, that's irrelevant because that's not what the story's about. The creation narratives are vehicles to express deeper spiritual truths. Things like, what kind of God is there? Or what is God like? Who were we as human beings? What is our relationship with God? How are we then called to live? And Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 is all about these questions. Their truth lies not in their science, which is borrowed, and is, by the way, 3,000 years out of date, but in the way they describe the great truths of life and the great truths of human existence. It's why the Bible can still have the capacity to speak to us today. Genesis and modern cosmology are not at odds with each other because they are not talking about the same thing, even though superficially it might look that they are. Albert Einstein famously had a quotation about this. In 1954, he said this. He wrote a little deal called Science and Religion. If one conceives of religion and science in terms of their actual definitions, then a conflict between them is impossible. For science can only ascertain what is, but not what should be. Religion, on the other hand, deals only with evaluations of human thought and action, religious things. It cannot justifiably speak about facts and relationships between facts, the science. According to this interpretation, he says, the well-known conflicts between religion and science, which were going on in his day, must all be ascribed to a misapprehension, you know, it's incorrect, of the situation which has been described. In other words, to expect Genesis to give a scientific account of the origin of the world, or to expect science to give us meaning, is to commit what is referred to philosophically as a category mistake. You know, you're just asking the wrong question of the wrong thing, and it doesn't work. But now we get to the real topic. There's a second level to our belief in creation that some see as being problematic in terms of the relationship with science. It involves the ongoing process that drives the universe, including the process we refer to by the term today, evolution, even though that's not the term that Darwin used, that's the one we use today. Here's the question, whether the power that lies behind the universe and the force driving the evolution of life is blindly deterministic or part of an ongoing creative activity, one we would see as being an activity of God as people of faith. This became an issue, again, because of the groundbreaking work of Charles Darwin. And again, this is one of those little historical facts I never realized. And again, natural selection as the driving force in evolution. When this was combined with Gregor Mendel, remember, when the book is first published, it's not creating a stir. It's only in the 20th century when we have neo-Darwinianism, you know, the grand synthesis and it begins to make sense and scientists begin to buy into it, that we begin to have some issues arising. And, you know, again, he explained how inherited traits can be transferred from generation to generation. When Origin of Species was published, many a people of faith openly embraced Darwin's work. Here's one of the great ironies of history. The religious community was quick to embrace Darwin. The scientific community was not. And they simply didn't see any conflict. So Frederick Temple, you may have never heard of him, but in this period of time, he was a great renowned scholar, Church of England priest, bishop, and he was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he expressed the views of many during this period. This is in the late 1880s. Nothing should be more welcome to people of faith than the extension of knowledge of any and every kind. Let me say it again. Nothing should be more welcome than the extension of knowledge of any and every kind. It's like in the Book of Discipline when we say that all truth comes from God. It's that kind of all-embracing statement. And so he runs the table. For example, if geology proves to us that we must not interpret the first chapters of Genesis literally, or if historical investigations show us that inspiration of the Bible, however it may protect the doctrine, yet was not empowered to protect the narrative of the inspired writers from occasional inaccuracy, or if careful criticism shall prove that there have been occasional interpolations and forgeries in the Bible, the book, as in many others, you know, mistakes creep in, the results should still be welcome. The substance of our teaching, the substance of our faith, the core of our faith, which we derive from the Bible, will not really be affected by anything of this sort. And his comments here are indicative of a wider response in the late 19th century. But to some, this implied that the natural order no longer needed God to explain how things were the way they were. And for example, some would later accuse the Archbishop of Canterbury, who we just heard, accuse him of heresy based on the statement that we heard. Flashpoints were in the area of geology, that the world was older than some had calculated. Remember that date of, you know, 4004 BC is a very recent date, but you know, it got into a Bible, people thought it was so. And people thought if it's the world is thought to be older, that somehow undermines our faith. So that became a flashpoint. And the other flashpoint, of course, was in biology, where evolution could explain creation without referencing God. And that was a flashpoint. Now, buckle your seat belts. Just let this hit you. In 1850, no one in the scientific community, I would think that even though this statement's made, yeah, there's got to be a few out there, but statistically, the scientific community as a whole, no one really doubted the existence of God. Yeah, there's a few people out there who believe anything, but essentially, no one doubted the existence of God. 20 years later, 1870, this had radically shifted, and the reason for this shift is easy to see, that right smack in the middle, Darwin published Origin of Species in 1859. So even though it wasn't accepted, it stirred things. Dawkins, one of our contemporaries, made this comment. Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So from the viewpoint of an atheist, if you have a mechanism that could explain something that people used to explain virtue of God, then that is something that speaks to them. Others, we know, took this further in ways that are much more hostile to religion and faith than Darwin ever was. Darwin's a fascinating guy. He was not anti-faith. He had a faith of source. His wife was a very conservative Christian. There's some books out there that can explore that if you're interested. Neo-Darwinian evolutionists in our time, say the last 20, 30 years, are among the most hardcore advocates of what is called ontological naturalism, that nature is all that exists. There is no God, there is nothing beyond just, you know, the facts. They claim that evolution is solely through natural selection and that you get this language, sheer, blind, random chance, meaning there is no guiding hand behind it. There is no purpose. They argue that empirical science can explain everything with no need, and this is Stringer's language, for the hypothesis of God, that there is no guidance or purpose in the universe. If you think that, it's just a delusion. And then what? In the last 15 years or so, you had the new atheist come stomping out. They're also been called the Four Horsemen. These are all operating essentially from a neo-Darwinian position although Dawkins is the only one that technically fits in that category. As with Galileo, the Darwin story has become this stuff of myth and legend. Most of it wrong. Now, James Moore wrote a book back in the 1990s. It is considered the classic, and still it's considered probably the gold standard in this. Wonderful historian, well-researched. He's actually a historian of science and a great authority on Charles Darwin and really on the whole, after Charles Darwin, how all this stuff played out. This is what he has to say. For more than a century, the age-long warfare between science and religion has functioned as a kind of creation myth for science to explain the world as seen in the light of modern science. According to this myth, the new nature, which by the way is a euphemism for science, science emerged out of the relentless conflict. You may remember that, 3 months ago, we actually spent a whole session on this, how this evolved in the late 1800s. Of reason versus faith, inquiry versus authority, truth versus error. Of course, religion is the error. And the greatest Victorian cause of this war was the heroic evolutionist Charles Darwin. That's the myth. Whose theory of evolution by natural selection finally, quote, disproved the book of Genesis, something that Darwin never said. But modernity's creation myth, too, tends to be undermined by familiarity with historical evidence. That is so often true. A great myth really works until you dig in and get the evidence, and then the myth falls apart. As a spate of recent scholarship has shown, Darwin's own Christian background, his lingering religious beliefs, and his attitude towards the faith of the others, specifically his wife, does not harmonize well with the old myth of scientific origins, and he's the great crusader. But the real issue is this. There's not an issue whether there's evolution, and there's not an issue of whether life evolves. The issue is whether such an affirmation is in conflict with religious belief in God as creator. The answer is clear. I'm going to run my flag right up the pole here. Evolution is perfectly compatible with belief in God. This may be one of those points we want to kick around. There is no inherent conflict between faith and God as creator and the theory of evolution itself. This is both from the science side and from the faith side. Natural selection, and this is again something you may want to flag to talk about. Natural selection, Darwin's idea, can be viewed as the mechanism through which God works, and even as evidence of the ongoing creative activity of God in the world. Many people of faith hold this view, as do most churches. The real issue is whether evolution is random, blind, pure chance, or whether it's being guided to a larger purpose. And let's be honest, that is not a scientific question. We said again, that is not a question that science can answer. It is a question that is profoundly theological and philosophical. When some argue that natural selection is blind or the result of random chance, they're making a statement that is ideological, philosophical. It is not a scientific statement, because there's nothing empirical about such claims. You think about the methodology of science, how science works. Those kinds of questions simply are not in the domain of science. Theists, us, people who believe in God, theos, can argue that natural selection and evolution are part of the overall process by which God continues to create. Theists, us, can see the same process and the fundamental drive towards increasing complexity in the universe itself. The forces that some would call blind, chance, and mechanistic are the exact same forces that produce increasing complexity, life, consciousness, and ultimately us. Another way to say this, and this is another talking point you may want to flag, is that behind genetics and natural selection lies a form of the anthropic principle. That we can see the anthropic principle not only in the universe as a whole, we can see the anthropic principle within life and within our lives. Conflict only arises when evolutionary scientists take the philosophical view of ontological realism. Big fancy term, but it means that only what can be documented by science is real, everything else is illusion. That's not a scientific statement. That is a philosophical, ideological statement. When in the name of science, some argue that mutation and natural selection prove that there is no design and no purpose, statements like these, again, they're not remotely scientific, even when they're made by scientists. Problems also arise, let's be honest here, let's own our own dirty laundry, when people of faith drink the lemonade of the Enlightenment and argue that to be true, the Bible must be factual. The rejection of evolution from some within the religious community is based on the assumption that God is not involved in the process of evolution. But there is nothing remotely biblical about that statement or that assumption. You may want to talk about that. The rejection of evolution by some within the religious community is ideological. It is not inherently biblical. You may want to talk about that. This means that neither aspect of creation faith, either as the beginning or as the ongoing process behind all we see, neither is at odds with science. But it is at odds with some ideologies put forth in the name of science, and it is at odds with ideological views of the Bible that hold it as simply a storehouse of facts, data, that has to be interpreted literally. There is a conflict there. So next week, we're going to be moving on to science and the reality of God, but